Books on Tape presents Reservation Road by John Burnham Schwartz. Read by Cassandra Campbell, Robertson Dean, and Arthur Morey. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me as a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. The Book of Job. Part 1. Ethan.
I want to tell this right. On a beautiful summer's day, we picnicked in a field as an orchestra played under a yellow tent. The clouds began to gather in the blue sky around 5 o'clock. Handel was finished, and Beethoven was still to come, the 9th with full chorus, and there were couples strolling across the lush green field, and 2 teenage boys tossing a frisbee back and forth, the white disc chased by a barking black dog. And then Emma stood up and said she wanted to go home. She was 8 years old and didn't much care for Beethoven. Grace suggested a walk instead, and Emma grudgingly accepted, and mother and daughter went off hand in hand, leaving Josh and me alone. Room was being made for the chorus under the tent. They stood on the grass in evening clothes, talking or limbering up their voices. Snatches of notes, bits of German, came floating over to us. And for perhaps the 2nd or 3rd time that day, I explained to my son that the final chorus of the 9th Symphony was in fact Schiller's Ode to Joy. Josh merely nodded. He was a thin private boy of 10 with dark, curly hair like mine. Sometimes he was a mystery to me. He'd been studying the violin seriously since his 7th birthday and was already well acquainted with Beethoven. Countless times he'd sat with me in my study, listening to a scratchy recording of the Bayreuth Festival Orchestra and Chorus performing the 9th Symphony with Elisabeth Schwarzkopf singing soprano. Now he reached into the pocket of his jeans and pulled out a flat, putty-colored stone. Staring off into the distance, he began polishing it with his thumb. I followed his gaze, and there was the black dog leaping into the air after the frisbee, and the frisbee floating just beyond the dog's reach. I asked him what he had there in his hand. He looked up at me, surprised, as if he thought he was alone. "That stone." "Arrowhead," he replied, looking away again. "Can I see it?" He shrugged, holding out his hand palm up. I took the arrowhead from him, turning it over in my own hand. It was a fine specimen, the point still defined, the surface at once jagged and smooth. "It's a nice one," I said. "Where'd you get it?" "Found it?" "You should take it into science class when school starts. You'd be a big hit with that thing." He shrugged. "When I was your age, I..." "Can I have it back now?" I felt the blood rise in my face. I had a powerful urge to throw the arrowhead across the field and into the trees, but I was his father and did no such thing. "Sure," I said. I gave it back to him. And then we sat without speaking for some minutes until Grace and Emma returned from their walk, and the 4 of us were settled peacefully again on our blanket. "Find anything on your travels?" I inquired. "A really fat lady," Emma said. "Emma," Grace said. "She was." "Shh," said Josh. "It's starting." The tent had fallen still, voices and instruments silenced. The conductor in his black tails tapped the air with his baton, and there was a single cough from an oboist in the 3rd row. And then the explosion of the 1st bars, like the sky opening. I looked at Josh. He'd shifted to his knees to get a better view of the violinists in the 1st row. His back had gone perfectly straight and his lips were moving. I will never forget the final movement. How the voices entered forcefully from the 1st, resonant yet still earthbound, to be joined by a multitude of others. How the sound grew from inside the yellow tent until it became a god, and the conductor's body seemed to beat to its calling. And finally, how my son, alone among us all, got to his feet and remained there, standing and silent, long after the music had ended. The sun was low in the sky when we started the drive back. It had fallen into a cloud behind the verdant trees, and the light emanating from there was seashell pink. In the back seat of the station wagon, Emma had fallen asleep with her thumb in her mouth, and Josh was staring out the window, humming. The next half hour or so was a disappearance. The light just withdrew, shrinking back behind the curtain. Roadside trees turned ever softer until, all at once it seemed, they were granite. I switched on the headlights. Heading south on Route 7, we crossed the state line into Canaan, bumped over the train tracks that ran there, past the Connecticut State Police barracks on our right, and then on our left my dentist, Dr. Zinser, and Tommy's Diner. A quarter of a mile further on, I turned east onto Reservation Road, which was the locals' shortcut between Route 7 and our town of Windham Falls. We were 20 minutes from home. It was dark now. Reservation Road was narrow and unlit and flanked throughout by woods on both sides. Above the trees, the sky sat like an enormous bruise. We were rounding a turn when suddenly I saw a stirring in the air at the outer edge of the headlight beams, like a small cloud of upward falling rain. The car punched into it, and instantly the windshield was splattered with dead insects. I braked hard, but kept the car rolling.
"What was that?" said Grace.
"Bugs," Josh said excitedly. "A swarm." I corrected him. "Mayflies."
"It's not May anymore," he said.
I switched on the wipers, but they succeeded only in streaking the glass with dead insects. When I tried for wiper fluid, I found there wasn't any. The wipers were squeaking against the glass, and I turned them off. I was irritable. The concert seemed long ago. "God damn it." In a sweet, just-awake voice, Emma said,
"Don't curse, Dad."
"I could have sworn you were asleep," I said.
"Damn isn't a curse," said Josh.
"Thank you, Josh." I tried to find his face in the rearview mirror, but it was angled up for driving at night, and all I could see was the smoke-black roof above his head. For some reason, the incident with the mayflies had unsettled me, as if I'd been grazed by a hand in the dark. Grace touched my arm.
"Okay?"
I nodded, relaxing a little at her touch. Then Emma said,
"I have to go to the bathroom."
Grace turned and looked at her.
"We're almost home."
"How long?"
20 minutes, tops," I said.
"I can't hold it."
Grace sighed.
"Yes, you can."
"I can't."
"She's being a baby," said Josh.
"I am not."
"Josh,"
Greg said,
"that's enough."
Then to me,
"Ethan, let's just stop."
"Absolutely not," I said.
"Anyway, stop where?"
"There's that little gas station just up ahead, isn't there?"
Yes, there was, just ahead. And I thought, the windshield was dirty with mayflies and we were out of wiper fluid. Perhaps we could buy some there. Todd's gas and auto body sat on the far side of a deep curve in the road, a break in the trees that might have felt like an oasis if it hadn't felt like a junkyard. The floodlight meant to illuminate the two old-fashioned pumps was broken, and the red neon sign that Todd's father had installed during headier days had been reduced by attrition to the first three letters, leaving a pitiful air of unfulfilled expectations. Half a wrecked car lay abandoned to the right of the low, flat-roofed building. It was a dark and uninviting place to be at night. The only indications of life were the buzzing three letters and a single lighted window next to the garage area, through which we could see, as we pulled in off the road, a young man sitting on a stool reading a magazine.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?